Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So, you know, we begin our show every single day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he appeared before the impeachment hearing in 2019. We also told you a couple of days ago, I think, that it turns out that Ken Burns, the famous documentary filmmaker, had done a series. And one of his series, way back when, was a story of the federal parks, the big national parks. And one of the parks is the Statue of Liberty. And he does a documentary about the Statue of Liberty. And it turns out that he interviewed a set of twins. They were 10 years old. Who were the twins? The Vindman twins at age 10. Why am I telling you this again now? Because I just saw Ken Burns on PBS telling us that they're going to replay some of those documentaries, including the Statue of Liberty one. So I want to make sure that if you don't watch any of them, you watch that one, because you're going to see a young Lieutenant Colonel Vindman at age 10. Even then, he stood out. Now, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, so Norm Solomon. Last time I was hanging out with Norm Solomon, I think it was during the primary, Norm, and right. I mean the presidential primary. And were we doing Amy Goodman's show? Is that why we were hanging
yes.
out together? I thought so. And it was wonderful. The two of us are incredibly left to progressive. We're both very hyperactive, and it was a wonderful conversation.
We were in sync, for sure.
We were definitely in sync. So I saw a piece that you had written at The Real News, Real People, and I read it, and I went, I got to reach out to Norman. So let me tell you who he is. He's the co-founder and national director of RootsAction.org. He was a Bernie Sanders delegate from California to the 2016 Democratic National Convention. He is the author of a dozen books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. What a clever title. He is also the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. So I want to welcome Norm to the program.
Thank you.
I'm also going to ask Norm to do something I have never, ever done. And I've been doing radio for a long time, Norm. You wrote this piece entitled Class War, Not the Media Hokey Pokey. It's what it's all about. Now, I want people to know that you wrote this and it was published on 5/21. In an interesting way, some of your lament and complaint was in part addressed by the New York Times front page, where they posted these very small obits of 1,000 of the 100,000 people who have died from COVID-19. And they, at least if nothing else, gave a human face or maybe a human coffin to the story of COVID-19. But I'm going to ask you, because it's not very long, to read your article, in part because it's so well written, and I want to be able to use that as the jumping off place for our conversation. So, Mr. Solomon, it's your podium. Class War, Not the Media Hokey Pokey, is what it's all about.
Journalists aren't supposed to bury the lead, but when death is the topic and corporate power is the culprit, the connection routinely goes unmentioned. Class war waged methodically from the top down is so consistent, so constant and pervasive that it might seem unremarkable. The 24/7 siege to make large companies more profitable and the wealthy more wealthy is going on all around us. In the process, it normalizes avoidable death as a cost of doing business. Overall, news media are part of that normalization. When negative coverage has happened, and it has happened, of Donald Trump, it's been common due to his handling of the pandemic. But media outrage has been muted in relation to the magnitude of the dying in our midst at a time when most of the dying could have been prevented. Deaths tend to become less newsworthy as the numbers mount and the shock gives way to tacit media acceptance. A new lethal reality is built on dominant structures that keep serving the financial priorities of the powerful. Emphasis is often less about saving lives and more about saving the stock market. The storyline becomes more about opening, less about dying, even though opening is sure to cause more dying. Patterns of economic injustice are so basic to the U.S. society that they amount to deep cracks in its foundation. Under the weight of catastrophe, whether hurricane or recession or pandemic, the cracks split wider and wider as more human beings, disproportionately poor and people of color, fall into the abyss. Corporate media narratives routinely bypass such core truths about cause and effect. Heartbreaking stories have scant context, victims without victimizers. Fueled by ultra greed, Trump's approach is a kind of scorched earth nonstop campaign, an extreme version of the asymmetrical class warfare that's going on all the time. The progressive publisher OR Books noted in an email to supporters this week, "The world before COVID-19 was a deeply unequal place. Now, in the pandemic, those inequalities are only more stark. Across America and around the globe are fabulous riches for a tiny few and deepening immiseration for everyone else." A swiftly infamous Instagram post by David Geffen, whose, quote, net worth, unquote, is $88.7 billion, in late March, showing his $590 million yacht at sunset as the pandemic took deadly hold in the United States. And he wrote, "Isolated in Grenadines, avoiding the virus. I hope everybody is staying safe," unquote. That became a symbol transcending avowed politics. Geffen is no right winger. He's a liberal. In the 1980 election cycle, he gave $1 million to Democratic congressional super PACs. He went on to become a donor to Pete Buttigieg's presidential campaign. But the most pernicious and ultimately destructive actions of the super wealthy are not so overtly gauche. The poisons are laced with soothing PR, while the rich movers and shakers play by the rules that capitalism has constructed for the voracious acquisition of wealth at the expense of everyone else. In that sense, the worst class war crimes are the ones that adhere to the rules and don't get singled out for condemnation. Consider the pathology of Jeff Bezos, reputedly the world's richest person, who commented that he couldn't think of much else to spend his money on besides programs for space travel. While back on planet Earth, the extent of misery due to poverty is staggering. Said Bezos, quote, "The only thing that I can see to deploy this much financial resource is by converting my Amazon winnings into space travel. That is basically it," unquote. For the likes of Bezos and other elite winners of riches, in the words of songwriter Tracy Chapman, a future awaits. "I won't die lonely. I'll have it all prearranged, a grave that's deep and wide enough for me and all my mountain of things." A few months into 2020, capitalism is running amok in tandem with the coronavirus, like some headless horseman galloping over dead bodies. Meanwhile, for U.S. news media, accustomed to covering faraway disasters, a reflex has set in close to home, turning the page on deaths, increasingly presenting them as numbers. An anesthetized pall of acceptance is descending on us. For the person who dies, there is an end, but there is not so for the person who grieves, the psychoanalyst Stephen Gross has pointed out. He added, "The person who mourns goes on living, and for as long as he or she lives, there is always the possibility of feeling grief." In his book titled The Examined Life, Grotz wrote, "My experience is that closure is an extraordinarily compelling fantasy of mourning. It is the fiction that we can love, lose, suffer, and then do something to permanently end our sorrow." The corporate system is looking for its own forms of social closure in the midst of the pandemic's colossal, deadly upheaval. Already, we're supposed to accept. Maybe you don't want to call it class war, but whatever you call it, the system always makes a killing.
So the idea of when the person dies, that's not where it ends. It's those that mourn that go on living. And I want people to recognize the amount of mourning that must be taking place in the United States today and around the world. We're hitting the 100,000 person mark. But that 100,000, Norm, they have family, they have friends, they have spouses, they have children, they have coworkers. The amount of grief must be enormous. And yet it's not even, I don't even know how to calculate that. And to some extent, the reason I said at the very beginning that this piece was written before the New York Times did that remarkable 1,000 sort of mini obituaries on their front page is that it isn't a number, but we are getting kind of numb to it, just the way we're getting numb to Donald Trump's tweets, just the way we're getting numb to Donald Trump's lies, just the way we're getting numb to how we need to protect ourselves so we can protect our neighbors, so we can protect our children, that somehow we have to genuflect to profit in the economy, and that we have to sacrifice our old people and sacrifice our poor people and sacrifice people of color. I said the other day that before the election, I want the New York Times to do it again. And maybe a couple of times. And maybe it'll fill an entire New York Times magazine section, not just a couple of pages, starting with the front page. And what I want them to do, Norm, is I want them to color code it. I want people to see how many people that are Black and Hispanic out of that number have been sacrificed to COVID-19. Because we have sacrificed them historically before. I want them to do a whole section on the number of frontline workers, from nurses and doctors and police and EMTs and bus drivers and railroad, you know, subway drivers. I want them to see how many of them have died. Because I think in some ways it isn't just even the generic number or even all the obits. It's who we were willing to throw under the bus, you know, and it needs to have a color. It needs to have a position. It needs to be a doctor. I want people to see this because it speaks so much about what Donald Trump is doing by sort of celebrating inhumanity.
The numbing is so tied in with who has power, who has the megaphone, who's able to be heard and who's validated. The victims that are worthy, the victims who are tacitly, by being omitted, not mentioned, downplayed, dubbed, in effect, less worthy. And I think it's the politicization of grief that through the platforms of corporate media really is so corrosive, because everyone who is a human being is someone who has loved ones, presumably. And it's the downplaying of grief for political purposes, let's face it.
Yes.
The horrible tragedy of 3,000 people being killed on 9/11 has, if we're going to talk about numbers and the circles of grief that have resulted, the 3,000 number has been dwarfed by 30 times over. And yet you have a president who barely acknowledges that anyone's suffering. And you compare that to what George W. Bush and other people appropriately did after 9/11. And I think news media as well, you know, I call it, and this is not an original term, I think it came from Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman, victims without victimizers, and victims and unworthy victims. And so how is it that we have, as you mentioned, mentioned, Arnie, 100,000 people already in this country, because of the structure, the economy, and the political non-leadership, the biggest hard-hit country in the world from the coronavirus. How is it that we now are in this situation where there is so little acknowledgement of not only the victims, but who are the victimizers? Who have politically and economically benefited from this widespread death?
But you know, Norman, it's the numbers, it's the leadership. I mean, we already knew the system was beginning to rot.
Right.
And all Donald Trump has done has exposed the rot in every way, shape, or form. And it's just, it's like, nothing surprises you. Nothing surprises me. I'm not surprised who has the pre-existing conditions. I'm not surprised who's being let to die. I'm not surprised who's the essential worker because he needs his damn pork chop or his hamburger. I know, I mean, it is so shocking to me, but at the same time, it's not shocking to me. Right. And what I'm trying to figure out is that combination between a Republican Party that is so blind in their allegiance and so intent on making sure that whatever exists in the way of what's left of our democracy in order to perhaps change the rot at the top is now also being undermined. It's profit, it's democratic institutions, it's the norms. I mean, they're not even gonna make a damn profit. You know this. This is gonna come back in a way that is unbelievable. So we will have lost people. We will have emotionally destroyed so much of America, and they're not gonna get their freaking profit because everything will fail again. You know, it's a scam.
Yeah.
It's a scam. But I'm just trying to figure out, why are these rich people going along with the scam? Because they're gonna get screwed too. They can be in their yacht like Geffen. I get it. But in the end, Geffen still needs the little people.
Yeah, I think it's a political and psychological equivalent of the CEO and the huge investors who only can see the next couple of quarters. They're kicking the can, this deadly, horrific can, down the road. But as you're pointing out, that only works for just so long. And then when you do it again, which Trump, who's really guilty of mass negligent homicide at best, it's just going to come back. What happens when you, for business reasons, not for health reasons, you quote unquote open up some states and communities? We know, because science does not yield to political nonsense, we know that there's going to be a new wave that is going to be increased because of this really cowardly, horrific so-called leadership in this national government.
But let me, and Ken, I'll go to you, Ken, but let me just say something. Let me tell you why I'm so angry. Because I'm seeing all these people sort of congregating together without masks, with no social distancing, you know, demanding certain things. And I am thinking, they're not just hurting themselves.
Right.
That now, when they get sick, they go and they're going to destroy once again this very fragile healthcare system that, you know, finally is producing enough ventilators, and most people die on ventilators anyway. And Donald Trump just said, oh, I'm going to produce 100 million swabs by the end of the year. We have over 300 million people. What's 100 million swabs?
Right.
What a joke. What a joke. He uses these numbers like the numbers are big, but they're not put in context with what is needed and what is being produced, and that who these people are going to hurt. I wish it was just isolated to them, but you and I both know they aren't just hurting them, they're hurting everyone. They're absolutely putting our frontline workers, especially those in our hospitals and our nurses, and they're risking their lives. Mm-hmm. The immorality of it is just astounding to me. And they want to go to church?
Yeah.
Oh my God, what the hell is church for? But it feels like it's a death camp. It's not a church. It's not a celebrate humanity. It's a place to exchange illness. It's just, oh, I'm so shocked and forlorn and so frustrated because I keep looking for a leader. And I have to be honest, I want a Joe Biden who can express this outrage. And you know who does it the best? Is someone who never made it, and I was told, oh, you know, he's not a great candidate or whatever. But I have to tell you something. I heard Cory Booker the other day. If anyone expresses outrage that touches my heart, I have to tell you, it's Cory Booker. If anyone expresses humanity in a way, it's Cory Booker. Yeah, I know him in the pharmaceutical companies, and I know, I mean, I get it. But I need a voice like that, and I haven't heard a voice. It's Pelosi doesn't do it. You know, Schumer doesn't do it. Biden doesn't do it. We need a voice of outrage that can contrast with the inhumanity of this president. And we haven't found that voice. And I really do think that people need to hear it to help inspire them for what we need to do, which is to take action in November.
Yeah.
Ken, I know you wanted to weigh in.
Yes, thanks. So much to weigh in on. I certainly, Norm, share your view about class war being the big problem. And I don't call it class war. I think that's what the Republicans and Trump have charged us with by daring to mention the big gorilla that's in the room that nobody else, especially the news media, pays attention. And that is the fact that, as Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have been saying all through the campaign, big business and wealthy people and Wall Street and big media companies are dominating our country, our economy, dominating our politics, and they are causing these huge disparities, and the rest of us are virtually powerless to deal with it. And also, we're working stiffs trying to make a living and support our families and having a hard time of it, while these guys go out on their yachts and act as if this is the norm. But what I really am frustrated about, Norm, and I've been talking about it a lot, is the role of the news media. And I know they're big corporate structures, but my God, how can it be that as you were writing, news media really normalize this kind of class distinction, rich, poor disaster, and not only don't get outraged by it, but they barely mention it. It's like you said, they get used to it and numb to it. And okay, let's move. We've already reported on COVID-19 and people dying. We've already reported on capitalists.
See, I think it's worse.
Disenfranchising and destroying families. So let's move on to something else, like this guy on his yacht.
Yeah, but Norm, see, what I think is happening is that Donald Trump is brilliant, because what he's doing is he throws something out and they follow it. And so he's dictating the story. He's dictating the headline. He's dictating where they're going. And they are allowing him to do it. And I that's the part that frustrates me, is that all these underlying stories that have to be told and repeated because they reflect our lives, those go to the back of the bus. And Donald Trump gets to drive the bus.
Well, repeated is a key word, because the essence of propaganda or important messaging is repetition. Yeah. And while we're so glad about the front page of the Sunday New York Times, we're unable in these islands of sanity to counteract the oceans of nonsense, of blather, of propaganda, of let's normalize this death that could be avoided. And as you say, the Trump messaging. And of course, Arnie, as you know, I wrote many articles very critical of Joe Biden during the last year. I avidly supported Bernie Sanders. At the same time, I got to say, we have now coming up a choice in November between a depraved, vicious, pathological liar named Donald Trump and a really mediocre candidate named Joe Biden. And particularly in swing states, I really do want to say it's so important for people to, whether they have to hold their nose or not, vote for Biden, because that is the only way to stop Trump from getting a second term.
But that's one of the reasons why the underlying stories have to be told, because that's what lifts Joe Biden up.
Yeah.
Joe Biden's not going to lift himself up.
Right.
But those stories of what is happening, that's what carries him. The story of the destruction, that's what carries him. You know, the people who are being sacrificed, that's what carries him. You know, and you're right, he isn't an inspiration. I get it. You know, and this is what I want, but this is what I got. So I have to deal with what I've been dealt. But the way to make what I've been dealt better is to make sure that people look at the stories that the media is not willing to cover and maybe shame them into covering it, making sure that it happens. Because people, that's why I wanted that story that the New York Times did to be color-coded, Do you know why? Because I want every Black and every Hispanic to vote. You know, I want them to understand that their lives are literally on the line, because look at this. This is death. Before, it's been a slow death. You know that. You know, when you don't feed people and you have them live in poverty and you have them live near, you know, dirty power plants, they die slowly. The vicious beauty of COVID-19, it happens in 14 days.
Right. Yeah.
And that's kind of what I see. And that's why I don't want any of this to be normalized, because once you normalize it, you deflate the vote and the response.
Yes. And I think it should be said that Republican governors in particular, while there have been some bright spots, every Republican governor who has failed to denounce Donald Trump's handling of this coronavirus are really accessories to the crimes.
Yes, absolutely. I can't even tell you. We're going to be talking to Bob Hennelly, and Bob Hennelly is an interesting guy. He writes for the Chief Leader. He covers the public sector unions, especially the public sector unions in New York. I've learned a tremendous amount from him. He'll be joining us afterwards. And one of the lines in his piece for today was something about that denial is a strategy.
Yeah.
Deny the idea that masks benefit. Deny the idea that of the contagion. Deny the true numbers of people who are dying. Denial is a strategy. But you know what denial equals? Death. That's
right.
What denial is. That's what it equals. It equals death. And it's not just Trump that is the colossal denier. It is these handmaidens, these GOP Republican governors that are aiding and abetting Trump, because Trump is so clever. He never takes responsibility for anything. He then sort of hands it off to the governors. Well, if the governors were smart, they would basically not accept that. But you got governors like my governor in the state of New Hampshire, who basically says, well, it's not appropriate for me to mandate masks. Appropriate? We're talking science, honey bun, not appropriate. But look at this. This is what we get, Norm. This is the language they use. And they're
in
fear
of
him.
It turns a governor, and unfortunately that does include the governor of New Hampshire, it turns them into death merchants.
Yes. Yes. They're and somebody has to say that to their face. It's like you and I said it. I want someone in the press to say it to their face. If this is what the science says and you refuse to mandate masks, what are you saying? Do you know what's really amazing? I'm gonna let you go. But we got millions of masks in because a businessman named Dean Kamen went to China and brought them back to New Hampshire. They are now, listen to what the governor is doing. He is now selling some of the quote unquote excess masks at the state-controlled liquor stores. Let me tell you about the state-controlled liquor stores. Nobody is mandated to wear a mask at the state liquor stores, neither the employees or the people that come in. And yet we are selling at these state liquor stores masks. Well, why? Do we really need them? Your employees aren't required to wear them. Either are people that are shopping at the state liquor stores. And then it turns out that a state employee at a liquor store a couple of weeks ago came down with COVID-19. It took them a week to tell anyone that it actually happened. And so guess what? We have also been a vector. We have also produced the COVID-19 for the people that came in to shop. This is the hypocrisy. Yes, they are death merchants. Norm Solomon, I gotta let you go. He is the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His piece that he read to us, Class War, Not the Media Hokey Pokey, it's what it's all about. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, let's go to a break. And when we come back, one of my faves, Robert Hennelly, joins us. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day trucking bosses and leading Teamsters in Minneapolis reached a tentative agreement after a tumultuous week of fighting in the city market. Strikers won many of their demands, including union recognition and the reinstatement of all strikers. Such a thorough victory at the Battle of Deputies Run earlier in the week had shaken the city's elites to their core. As the dust settled on the picket picket lines, Governor Floyd Olson had called a 24-hour truce in an effort to organize negotiations. The debacle of Ohio National Guardsmen attacking Toledo strikers had reached Minneapolis. Fears of a growing red menace fueled demands for a settlement, prompting Olson to order National Guardsmen into the city's armories armed to the teeth. Historian Brian Palmer, author of Revolutionary Teamsters, The Minneapolis Trucker Strikes of 1934, observed that the May 25th deal settled the strike quickly enough, but final victory would be postponed. Strike leaders had to choose which concessions to make under immense pressure from state politicians, intractable employers, and federal mediators. They also worked to avoid a potentially deadly confrontation with the National Guard. Above all, they demanded union recognition, agreed to arbitration of future disputes, and withdrew the demand for a closed shop. There was no contract, and the inclusion of inside workers proved contentious. Palmer adds the gains were limited but real enough, as strike leaders spelled out what had begun as a violent assault on strikers ended with workers fighting in their own interests, learning that they had only their union to rely on. The open shop offensive was defeated, and union recognition was won. In the weeks ahead, it would become clear the fight was far from over. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. First you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Well, he's back. Who am I referring to? Bob Henley. Bob Henley writes at Stuck Nation. He writes for The Chief Leader. He writes for Salon.com. And not only is he prolific, but he gets us to focus on the frontline workers that sometimes disappear in the storylines. And because he writes for The Chief Leader, which really works and focuses on public employees, it's very important that we talk to him, because these really are the first responders. They are the frontline workers. But there were two pieces that you wrote on. And the one I want to start with first is the frustration you have with the governor of New Jersey and Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump is really good at getting people to heal. And I think you know what I mean by right. that. So why don't you share with our audience what Governor Murphy did and why it is so frustrating to you what he did? because this Democratic governor is now going to be useful to this evil president, because he will use him against the very people that Governor Murphy wants to protect.
Right. I think that it goes back to a decision by the governor April 30th to go down to the Oval Office to burnish the image of President Trump at really a crucial time. It's important in this to look at the TikTok narrative. Yes. We went through a situation through the middle of April where the President of the United States committed what I believe is certainly an impeachable offense when he started to encourage insurrection by egging on armed groups to descend upon states like Michigan, Virginia, and Minnesota to the state capitals, and basically calling upon them to quote-unquote liberate the state capital from Democratic senators, or no, rather governors, who were truly just trying to use public health science to guide the decisions they were making. And
from his own health people. Wait a minute, let's remind everyone. It's not like his own doctors that basically stood up with him were suggesting exactly how these governors were behaving. They were following the rules and suggestions set in place by his own people. But yet, it's like there's a disconnect between what they are saying and what Donald Trump is attempting to do.
Right, and it's put in the context that he was, of course, ignorant and frustrated the initial response by not dealing with it officially. Then when the states attempted to race to get the personal protective equipment that his federal government failed to have in place, he then proceeded to try to subvert that effort by playing them off against each other, so that they couldn't have as an effective a response as if the federal government responded collectively. And so it's in that universe where we see Phil Murphy, a former Goldman Sachs official, go down there to Washington and as I said, burnish the president by sitting less than, closer than 6 feet, knee to knee, mask on.
Yeah, knee to knee, their knees were touching.
That's right, and then behind them, to show you that this was premeditated political malpractice, there was a chart of the White House and New Jersey in partnership together, where he proceeded to let President Trump use him for one of his magical mystery tour press conferences, where he demeaned the former sitting president of the United States, Barack Obama, and former Vice President Biden, while also for good measure reprising the Flynn escapade. While our governor sat there and just smiled and signed off and couldn't have been any more obsequious than if he had been like a concierge parking Trump's car.
Obsequious. That's exactly what the word I was thinking as I'm reading your article. Like, where's your spine? Where's your sort of sense of self-worth? How could you listen to this? Go on.
Well, so now, though, this really creates a difficulty because New Jersey itself right now is in a circumstance where I think that there's been several days we've had more deaths than New York, than our neighbor. And we're a couple, I guess, maybe 7 or 8 days behind the arc of what's happening in New York City. And the reality is that this Murphy came away without anything. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, if you're going to be obsequious, come away with something in hand. And even during that meeting, when Murphy attempted to try to make a church mouse sound about getting state and local aid from the Congress and trying to get Trump support, all the Trump would give him was that was a tough call. And so, and then of course, there's no sense of solidarity. I think this is part of the problem where there is a chance that Trump could win re-election, because the fact that Phil Murphy thought that was okay after what happened to Governor Whitmer in Michigan, no sense of solidarity, no sense that he was an historical figure at a turning point. And I think that's the thing. People think that history happens to somebody else. And if you go back and look at the other periods of time that are equivalent, the American Revolution, Governor Franklin, who was the illegitimate son of Benjamin Franklin, was thrown into jail because he was a loyalist and eventually went to Canada. We had, during the time of the Civil War, we had a state that voted by popular vote against Lincoln twice, but the governors had to navigate something that matched the moment as they saw it. In this case, you just have Governor Murphy going along with where he thinks in his Goldman Sachs limited thinking the power is right now. And the reality is that when you're in a historic moment facing a despot of the scale of Donald Trump, you have to have courage. Otherwise, yes, he looks to me like the Vichy French, I got to tell you.
No. Bob, that is the shocking thing. Donald Trump is a coward. Donald Trump is a coward. And yet what is so amazing is how he has castrated not only the entire Republican Party, but he basically castrated Chris Murphy. I mean, let's be honest. If someone was saying that about all these people that you know was totally untrue, and to sit there and to accept it, I would have stood up and said, I'm sorry, Mr. President, but what you have said is patently false. And I cannot aid and abet this falsehood. I think I need
great
to end
moment.
This conversation.
And that's a profile of courage that we didn't get to see. And that is juxtaposed on a Memorial Day where we are not keeping track of all of the essential workers who have already perished in this pandemic. There are heroes all around us that are remaining obscure. You have to comb through the obituaries, and maybe way down there in the death notice, it's a reference that the person was a police sergeant or a nurse or a doctor. We don't even have a sense of the scale of this yet.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I'm concerned about, is that there's all this sacrificing going on, and we're really not taking full measure of what the significance of it is, because this, the folks that are dying here are the front lines. They are the backbone of our civil society. These are the people that serve no matter what, who always answer the call. And if we're not attentive to that, then we're not attentive to our own survival.
Well, so you did not hear the conversation I just had with Norm Solomon, but I've been saying this over and over again, that we need to not just have, how do I say this without hurting anyone, a generic 1,000 people who have died from COVID-19. We need to color code it so you know how many of them were Black and Hispanic. We need to give them the idea that these were the frontline workers. These were the doctors. These were the subway drivers. These were the police. People need to see that the consequence of this is not just across the board, but you are losing, as you point out, the basic sort of structure of who we are that keep us safe, that keep us healthy, that make sure that we can manage to get to work. These are the people that are being forced to confront sometimes with not the right amount of PPEs. Tell this story about, you send me a second story about, you know, how Donald Trump is trying to undermine the federal unions. And right, this goes directly to both not only protecting folks that are traveling by air, but protecting the people that are responsible for making sure that these people are safe. And what does Donald Trump do? He makes sure that once again, they deny and delay whether they have the protective equipment they need, even when they're begging for it.
So this is a crime in progress. We have been reporting this as a series of things that happened in the past where Donald Trump's efforts to hide it, to downplay it, to put the markets in higher preeminence, to make it seem that we weren't really facing a crisis. But the reality is that the denial and obstruction is continuing even now. And I'll give you an example.
This is incredible.
Very early on, people may not be aware of this, but in 1962, President Kennedy signed an executive order which granted collective bargaining rights to federal unions, and so to the federal workforce. And so currently, the American Federation of Government Employees represents around 700,000 of the 2 million federal workers. And they hold all kinds of job titles from TSA, Transportation Security Administration, screeners, and everything like the nurses in the prison systems. Right. Just any place that there's a federal installation, there's people working inside it that are civilians. 9 chances out of 10, they're represented by the American Federation of Government Employees. Historically, no matter, with the exception of Reagan with PACO, where he fired the air traffic controllers, over all these years, through all these different presidencies, Republican or Democrat, there was a fundamental respect for the civil service. And so you had a kind of professional cadre that grew up in it. So you had career scientists in Fish and Wildlife, career scientists in the EPA, the USDA, who had could make a lot more money in other parts of the economy, but had a civic public commitment to serving the general public. Many of them are veterans. So Trump went to war with these unions from the very beginning of the administration and tried to drive them out of the places where they were working and tried to subvert the unions, and in the process lost a major way that historically the workforce has been managed in a pinch whenever there was a crisis, because it's a lot more efficient and effective to have a union workforce that communicate effectively with management and get back to management when something's not working. Here's how Donald Trump's hatred of the federal unions helped spread and is still spreading COVID. This disease first stepped off in England, where it was noticed that there at Heathrow, the screeners, the TSA equivalents working in that country were coming down with COVID. Then it showed up in TSA workforce in California. Within 2 days, this is like before the 15th of March, the AFT is out with a letter pleading with the TSA and the Trump administration to provide masks and PPE. That was ignored and has been ignored up until May 7th.
Wait. When did you say they first noticed it in England?
This was the beginning of March. So March.
I want people to understand this. Okay, keep going.
Right. And so a letter is written by Dr. Everett Kelly, the head of the AFGE, to the TSA and to the Trump administration, asking that there be PPE applied so that the members can protect themselves. Remind you, at this point, we haven't had a lockdown, so we have people flying all over the place.
Right.
And so it was not until May 7th. This was a month after the CDC flipped and decided the general public needed to wear masks. And indeed, it was after the private airlines like JetBlue, the carriers were requiring that masks be in play. And to this day, when I interviewed Dr. Kelly just last week, the TSA was still refusing to test the workforce. So this kind of mismanagement is continuing across federal enterprises, in the Bureau of Prisons, in the Veterans Administration, and it's continuing to happen today. And so that's why I'm saying that we're not getting our arms around it. And this is not something where there's been any break in it. And the media is really not focusing on the role that the federal government plays as an employer, as an entity that has, give you an example, the meatpacking plants. There have been USDA members of AFG who have died, who inspect meat and poultry caught in these godforsaken places that Trump has bullied people to go to back work in. This is continuing.
Yeah. Well, Ken, what was the story about the liquor stores in New Hampshire? It's exactly the same story. Here we have a governor who will not mandate masks. Right. It's a recommendation. And it turns out that the New Hampshire liquor stores were essential workers, okay? It is a huge revenue generator for the state of New Hampshire. It wasn't open for New Hampshire. It was open for Vermonters and New Yorkers and Massachusetts people, because trust me, if you look at the parking lot, you don't see New Hampshire plates, you see plates of everyone else, because we get the cheapest booze in the Northeast, if not in the country. So you know that there, so what does he do? So you know that, and let's be honest here, Bob, who comes to a liquor store and is desperate for alcohol? Probably someone that has underlying health issues, okay?
Right.
Probably someone who might even have COVID, okay? So these people are coming in. The workers there are not mandated to wear masks. The people that are coming in are not mandated to wear masks. Now they have the chutzpah of selling masks at this place where they're not mandated to wear masks, either from the employer perspective or from the people who are coming in. I mean, and the governor is saying that, you know, it's just not appropriate for New Hampshire to mandate mask wearing. Well, it's not appropriate. It should be essential to keep people alive, whether it's their workers or the people that are showing up in the damn stores. Look at what's going on at the micro level, just like what you described between the federal unions and President Trump.
Right. I think also the problem here is that I think Pew estimates that we've talked about this before, around 47% of our local reporters in the last 10 years.
Yes. Exactly.
And so this stuff is playing out where we're seeing the deaths occur for first responders, federal civil servants, even volunteers. I mean, one of the things that's been very sad is to see the retired cadre that maintain all of these food pantries, who were the people that continued, despite the fact they were over 65, this is the volunteer activity they committed to, and continued to serve at their own peril, even as the need exploded, and there was, they were trying to catch up with the protocol to try to keep themselves safe.
So, you know, you mentioned what happened with the media, and that there's, that really, not only the media that we have left somehow disappoints, we were just talking about that, Ken, with Norm Solomon, all right, this sort of corporate media, and that a lot of the reporters are gone, especially at the local level. We're talking about the beat reporter at the state level or the beat reporter at the city and town level. But the story I was just telling you about the liquor stores and whatever, this is how it was framed by New Hampshire Public Radio, that the governor quietly made the decision to do this. No, nothing's quiet. It's just, there's no one to follow the story. There's no one to cover the story. It's not that it's quiet. It's that there are no more journalists to be able to do the coverage. There's nothing quiet. It's just that it's invisible if there's no one there to write the story, or there isn't a paper there to deliver the story, or if there isn't a media there to share the story. That's the problem. Nothing is quiet. It's just not covered.
Yeah, but just to be clear, Arnie, the lack of coverage is not because there are no journalists in the state of New Hampshire at all. The journalists that are here, and there are many of them, and they're local newspapers, but they're out covering, oh, gee, here's a picture of this nice family out on their swings in the public park, or here's these families who are wearing masks, and here are these lunatics who are on the legislature steps saying we should open everything up. Then there are journalists out there, they're just not covering stories like this that are important about decisions that the governor of New Hampshire makes.
So Bob, let me just say something. Ken, let me disabuse you of that. Because I remember when I was a young legislator, and Bob, you can probably confirm this, I would go into the press room, and the room was oozing with reporters. I mean, oozing. They were flowing out the door. The room is basically shut, okay? Not just because of COVID, but because there's nobody left. You know, there's one AP reporter left. The Concord Monitor is probably, it's 3 pages long of news, right, and they're desperate for unpaid interns to show up who have no, you know, institutional memory. That's part of the problem too, Bob.
Yeah,
it's not just that they don't exist. It's that when you lose that institutional memory that a Robert Hennelly has, then guess what? You don't even know what to cover or ask the questions to ask because you don't have that muscle.
Well, and public policy and politics have to be framed around situational awareness.
Yes.
And how do we get that situational awareness? But by reporting. And I think that we have Donald Trump to some degree because of this deterioration. In 2016, going to places in Pennsylvania, Michigan, you could see that there was no recovery. We've talked about this. We could see that there was this disenchantment that people had not experienced any kind of rebound coming out of the 2008 disaster. There was still foreclosures. There were 6,000 zombie homes in Cleveland where the convention was. And so there's been a disconnect for a long time. And you may remember that the media's response to this when Trump won and their polling was wrong and they missed this upheaval was, oh my gosh, and you had, I remember Ted Koppel, who I respect, discovering West Virginia. Everyone put their pith helmet on, and let's go find fly country. I guess we missed the nation. And then, of course, the Russian thing gave them an out.
Yes.
And that's what they hung on to. It could be the fact that in our ivy towers, in our black cars, in our seven-figure salaries, that we missed the misery of our countrymen. It was the Russians that did it.
So let me just say something. So one of the things that we're hearing now from Donald Trump suddenly cares about education. No. He doesn't give a crap about education. The reason he wants schools open is not because he cares about whether little Johnny is going to learn his math and his reading. It's because he needs to make sure that the daycare happens.
Right.
Because he needs to make sure that the kids that are home, that somehow are keeping their parents from going back to work because he's opening us up for business, that those kids are in school. There hasn't been a reporter that says to him, really, Mr. President, you care suddenly about public education? Then where is the extra billions, if not trillions, in order to make sure that when those kids kids go to school, you've increased the size and the space and the PPEs and the extra staff that is going to be necessary so those kids are safe, so those kids are educated, so their teachers don't come down with COVID. If you want this so desperately, like you suddenly have been turned on to public education, which we know is bull crap, then you need to tell us where's the cash to make it possible that these kids can go back safely and the teachers can teach safely. You can't have education without the additional dollars. And you need education because you want damn business to open. They don't. If they focus on these little tiny storylines, they don't connect the dots.
And it's even more diabolical in the sense that they're using this depression and the collapse of the markets as a way to create a mindset of scarcity and anxiety in the population, where they'll drive people back to work, who will then try to, they'll have to sublimate the risk and anxiety that they face in terms of not being properly protected going into an environment where they know these precautions haven't been taken. It's also something I think that they also still, the right wing, and I think that they, and the neoliberals to some degree too, still ascribe to this thought that there's a certain number of individuals that are expendable, and this is just a cost of carrying on. And if we can only blast through this and get onto the other side of it, we can beat it. And I think that that's going to be, that's a disaster in the making, and it's, and there's very little pushback on that. But that's kind of what the policy that's driving all of this is, that we're going to develop herd immunity and it'll be just a bad dream, and grandma lived too long anyway.
Yeah, but it's not grandma. I mean, yes, it's grandma. But as you started this conversation, it was those public sector workers.
Right.
That is our basic infrastructure of a civilized society that are being sacrificed.
Right.
There are consequences to when doctors and nurses die. There are consequences to when cops die. There are consequences to when people that pick up your garbage die. There's consequences to when people that work in those pork plants and hamburger plants, whatever they are, die. I hate to say this, is that they think that they won't be noticed.
Right,
but
exactly.
It will be noticed. That's the irony here. There is no one that is expendable, especially at the bottom. Because let me remind you, they're like the foundation of a house.
Right.
You can have a beautiful mansion, but if your foundation is rotted out, the mansion disappears. And that's what they're doing. They're killing the foundation.
Exactly.
And someone needs to point that out. And that's the part that is so frustrating to me, is that's the objective of the media, is to connect those dots.
Well, I'm glad we get to those connect those dots here.
Well, we absolutely do. Robert Hennelly, join us anytime.
Thank you.
Go to @StuckNation to read more about him. Check him out at Salon.com, the chief leader, or check out my Facebook page.
Thanks so much, Arnie.
Thank you so much. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude. We'll chat tomorrow. Ciao.
Thanks.
Well, a doctor comes round here with his face all bright, and he says in a little while you'll be all right. All he gives is a humbug pill, a dose of dope, and a great big bill. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and rain? Me and my old school pals had some mighty high time.